This call is being recorded.
Hello, today is April 1st, 2020. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. And this is one more of my ongoing series of interviews with the various LSAT tutors who generously contribute their time and guidance at the Facebook group, LSAT Study Group, which is facebook.com/LSAT Study Group. And today I'm speaking with Cade Underwood, who is a Philadelphia, Pennsylvania based LSAT tutor who does both online and live tutoring in the Philadelphia area. Grateful for his joining me today. How are you today, Cade?
I am excellent. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, you're very, very welcome. And I'm sitting here sort of in lockdown mode in Toronto, Canada. It's like half the world is shut down. And what's your world like in Philadelphia?
Yeah, it's similar over here. I mean, I don't think we have an official lockdown order, but we definitely have a shelter in place order. Been mostly inside my house for the last, 10, 14 days now. But hopefully we can get everybody to start staying inside so this thing actually doesn't spread anymore.
Oh my God. Is that changing your life radically to stay in the house that much? Or?
It's a little different. I usually am going to campus, to the University of Pennsylvania campus pretty often and, moving around and about. I stay outside a good bit, but, it's not too horrible. We just all got to adjust for the, public health of everybody.
Okay, so if you're going to the University of Pennsylvania campus, that means you're at the University of Pennsylvania. So tell me a little bit about that. What program are you in?
Yeah, absolutely. So as we might talk about later, I started my LSAT tutoring originally by studying for the test myself. And I am a current student at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I'm also doing a dual degree with the Weitzman School, doing a master in city planning.
So that's going to take you how many years then to do the dual degree?
It's a four-year degree. So the first year is all planning and the last 3 years are a mix of the two.
Okay, so you haven't had the experience of officially actually starting law school yet.
I have not officially started law school yet, but that's coming on soon.
Okay, so I guess the way it works is you're getting advanced standing between the various two courses you take for the law school go towards the planning degree and vice versa.
Yeah, they both basically, you just don't get any electives for both programs. And then all the elective credits just end up being credits towards the other degree. So usually a master's would be 2 years and the law degree 3 years. But if you do them together, you can do it in four by sharing a few of the credits.
So definitely a much more efficient use of your time. And I assume that lowers the overall cost of the experience as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I decided I wanted to do both of these degrees, the dual degree seemed like a no-brainer because one fewer year of school, and also less money that you're spending to get the education.
So I'm kind of assuming here that given this joint program, city planning or whatever in law, that you're seeing the law school as an extension and enhancement or a way to give legal definition to the master's program. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's honestly the opposite. So I intend to be a lawyer. I think that unless you're getting some significant funding, most people that go to law school shouldn't go to law school unless they want to be a lawyer. The Master's of City Planning adds depth to that law degree. I would like to work with city planning policy. I would like to make policy in general, specifically interested in housing and labor law and policy, and having that city planning background and understanding some of the technical tools that planners use and that public officials use is definitely an important additive to a law degree and a legal career.
Well, very interesting. Very often I've been asked in my life, you know, what's a good area of law to go into, or, you know, some equivalent kind of question. And it seems to me that law is so broad. The real question should be, you know, what are you interested in general? And, you know, let's see if we can find a way to turn that into a legal career. But anyway, that's great. Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about how you got there. That's where you are today. And you tell me that in addition to LSAT tutoring, that you actually got your start through SAT and ACT tutoring. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and it wasn't just SAT and ACT tutoring. I've actually also done a lot of work in outdoor education. I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina, the Blue Ridge, for anyone that's from that area. And I grew up doing a lot of camping, hiking, backpacking, and started doing some camp counseling and some other outdoor education, which eventually turned into some study abroad, trip leading as well. But the whole point of outdoor education is that you have to be really creative with the tools you have in the wilderness, because you don't have the same tools you have in the classroom. So I think a mixture of that creativity and that sort of passion and excitement for teaching, and then going into SAT and ACT tutoring, really learning about standardized testing and how standardized testing is very unique, and how you have to approach it, how you have to teach it, and how you can learn it. Both those things came together for me. And then when I started studying the LSAT, I realized that the LSAT is probably the most interesting, challenging, and fascinating test, at least that I've had experience with. And it all kind of culminated in a small business for me, being able to do something I enjoy and, you know, continue challenging myself and stay on my toes with this very fascinating and very challenging test.
Well, it is fascinating. And one of the things from doing this interview series that I've discovered is that all really good LSAT tutors, it seems to me, I really do find the test exciting and have a passion for it. And I have the impression that includes you as well. Is that true?
Yeah. Like we were talking about before, I think that, you know, as somebody who plans to go into a career in social and economic justice in my law career, I don't always think the LSAT is the best way to decide who becomes our next generation of lawyers. However, that is the world we live in, right? And in that world, I do find the LSAT to be extremely fascinating and challenging and fun to work with. So yeah, I definitely have a passion for the challenge of the test. It's just like this really interesting puzzle that's constantly changing. So I love teaching it. And that's why I now only really teach the LSAT and not some of the other standardized tests that I used to teach.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit. You know, you said two things. The first was that you didn't, you didn't quite put it this way, but it sounds to me as though you're saying that you don't approve of or agree with the extent of the role that the LSAT plays in law school admissions. Do I have that accurately?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it should have as much weight, like a standardized test that so clearly depends upon your ability to prepare for it. And sometimes that means the money you have to put into preparing for it, like, shouldn't be the primary tool or one of the primary tools for deciding our next generation of lawyers. But that is the world we live in right now. So we got to work with that.
Okay. So, you know, that's what you're saying is that there's sort of an access to preparation issue for LSAT. But what other, if any, issues do you see in terms of, you know, the suggestion that LSAT should not play as large of a role as it does, cultural or otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest problem is the one that I mentioned, just with like any education resources. When people are born in a situation where they have more access to resources, they usually end up with better outcomes, just because we live in a society that kind of works that way, unfortunately. I think there are certain things about the LSAT that make it more challenging and less challenging for different types of people. It's also extremely emotionally and sort of psychologically intense. And that can impact people that have like learning disabilities or maybe anxiety issues more than other people. So it's definitely not necessarily a fair test in a lot of ways, but it is a definitely a good tool to prepare you for the kind of thinking that you will need to do in law school and in your legal career. So in that way, I think it does work quite well.
Well, let's focus a little bit on the type of thinking. Maybe you can link that also to what you said earlier about your personally finding the LSAT to be an exciting and engaging and interesting experience. What is this kind of thinking that the LSAT is testing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can break it down in a lot of different ways. You know, at surface level, it's testing your logical reasoning skills, right? I mean, that's one of the sections in the test, but it's really the basis for the entire test. And to some degree, your reading comprehension. It is a test in English. You're definitely going to have a harder time with this test if English is not your primary language. And you haven't read, you know, more dense, difficult texts in English in your life. So those are sort of the surface level skills. I think a little bit deeper than that, the LSAT has a certain logic that it prescribes to, sort of like in, you know, a classical European tradition of logic, that you have to learn if you want to do well at this test. Some people sort of innately or from their prior education have experience with that and do better up front. And some people don't. And so in terms of the language that the test uses and some of the ways that it approaches logic and comprehension, you definitely have to get inside the mind of the test maker, the LSAC, the Law School Admissions Council. If you want to perform well on the test, you got to get inside that mind and understand how they think. I often have conversations with my students where they get frustrated and they're like, well, this shouldn't be the answer. That doesn't make any sense. And instead of, you know, entertaining that possibility, I try to twist it around and say, well, fine, that may be true, but this does make sense in terms of the test. This is what they expect. So if you can learn what they expect and get used to it for the future, then you'll perform better on this test and you'll be more prepared for questions like this in the future. So it's really all about understanding what they're asking for.
And part of what I thought I heard you say was an understanding what they're asking for was a certain sensitivity to language they use. You use the word language. Do you have any, provide an example of that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. If I had some more time and looked at some of my materials, I could think of lots of examples. But the one that comes to mind is just the usage of words like some and many versus most, all, none, sort of like quantity indicators or measure words, if you will. You know, for some people, many means something like colloquially that's different than what the LSAT means when they say the word many. You know, in the LSAT, it's sort of this indiscriminate term to mean some amount that doesn't really tell you very much information. Though in real life, when some people think of many, they may think of like, you know, a ton, like a lot, like more than half or something. So you really have to understand like what the test means when they say certain different words, and how you can, you know, harness that to get closer to the right answer, or the credited answer in each question.
And what would you think in terms of, I mean, let's say that you're looking at a word like, say, some or many or any other word on the test, particularly in answer choices for, say, logical reasoning. What would be the principle, in your view, for how to best understand language on the test while you're reading it and absorbing it? I mean, it's a horribly difficult question to throw at somebody, but I apologize for that. I don't take it personally, only because I think you probably handle it. But, you know, so you've got somebody who's reading language. I mean, what advice would you give somebody for how to read language effectively on the LSAT?
Yeah, I mean, the basic answer is just like you have to read everything very literally and very explicitly, right? People go into tests and they try to assume things based on their prior knowledge. Often I have some of the hardest trouble with students who like have a lot of experience in like maybe a scientific field or sociology or something where they want to bring in all this extra information into the test.
They know a lot about the subject. They know a lot about the subject question.
Right, because you can only really work within the confines of what the test gives you. So, I mean, the basic advice is just read it really literally. What it says, it's like read it at face value. But you know, more than that, that's sort of where tutors come in, right? Like that's where all the test prep materials and the tutors come in to guide you through the process. Because there's lots of different components to understanding all these language cues that the test gives you. Yeah, but I think that's basically it. And I think another interesting thing about the test is that, you know, if you look at any argument or anything in the world, there's some amount of assumptions that are built into it, even in this test, right? It is very literal and it's very explicit, but there are some assumptions that you can make at different times that are okay. So it's sort of learning about when you can make assumptions and when you can't. That really just takes experience. You can do that on your own with materials you purchase, or you can do that with a tutor, which will make it go a lot faster. But you have to learn those cues and those specific words.
Those cues and words surely should be learned in the context of actual past LSAT exams. Would you agree?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I only use problems from actual real past exams. A lot of the larger companies will produce their own materials. This is usually less of a problem with the LSAT because I think they realize that it's really hard to reproduce LSAT materials. Usually they do this a lot more with the SAT and the ACT. And even that can be a problem. And the GRE they do it with. But yeah, you shouldn't be working with any materials that aren't actual, you know, real old LSAT questions.
How many released LSATs are there? I think it's in the 90s now, is it?
I think we're at 89, is the latest one they released in February. I could be wrong. It's 88, 89, or 90. But in terms of the ones that have been given, yeah, I think we're in the early 90s. It just takes them like 6 months or something to actually sell the test after it's been given.
I understand that they've since they've converted this thing to tablet form or whatever. I understand that they're now selling some kind of $100 access for a year or something. You can get access to all these LSATs.
I actually haven't seen that. I'll need to look into that recent more. I kind of stick with the paper materials for now. But considering that a lot of the supply chains are dried up because of the pandemic, that's a good thing to look into. I'll check that out.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. Now back to your talking about, you know, the advice that you would give on language and reading and interpretation. You know, you use the word read literally. Would an equivalent way of saying read literally to be sort of read as a minimalist, like how much do we know for sure, then stop before, you know, trying to infer too much?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest problem that I see with new LSAT students is they really try to extrapolate way too much, whether it's on the questions or the stimulus or the answer choices, like what is being said or what can be included. So I think that's a big problem, trying to extrapolate too far. Like what it says, like you have to take it at face value. If it says this, it says this. Another thing that I run into trouble with is people often they don't answer the question that's being asked. So often students will sort of read through the question but not fully understand it and like answer kind of the question that they feel like they should be answering when it's not actually the direct explicit question that's being asked. So being really literal, really explicit, and paying attention to cue indicator words, like I mentioned before. The quantity words are really important, none, most, some, many. And there's plenty of other cue words too, that are pretty crucial to doing extremely well on this test.
Well, I think that your point about some people not being clear on the question, answering what they think the question should be, is a good one because my experience with this stuff was that LSAT often includes things that would be the right answer to a different question.
Yeah, and, I think a lot of the power score and some of the other materials refer to it as the shell game. Answer choices, the ones that it's sort of like the little shells or the little cups when you swivel them around and there's like a little ball underneath. People do that in the streets sometime in cities. It's something where it's like you think it's the right answer. It like appears to be the right answer, but there's something hidden within it, like one word or two words that makes it completely wrong. Those are obviously some of the biggest trap answer choices that you'll come across.
And what about, you know, it also seems to me while we're talking about answering choices that the ordering of language in answer choices makes a huge difference. I mean, the way I experienced a lot of this stuff was that one of the things that LSAT is very, very good at is through the use of leading language in an answer choice that gets people to sort of psychologically or emotionally either commit to it or reject it before reading all the words that follow. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the biggest, most difficult things for students to internalize because often LSAT students are very driven. They're very smart. They've like succeeded a lot in their lives, but this test is unlike anything they've seen generally. And so they want it to be very easy and they easily get sucked into these tricks that the LSAT plays on them. I think, you know, what I like to tell my students is that you start to notice them the further you go into it and the more experience you get, but there's a lot of like incorrect answer choices. Usually incorrect answer choices will have the wording that you want from a correct answer choice, but there's something that's wrong with it. They have a lot of the same words that were used in the passage. There's something that makes it completely incorrect. Whereas the correct answer choice, the credited response, will have words that you don't think are completely the same as the original question, or maybe they've changed it a little bit, or they're slightly different. However, they're the only one that you can prove is true. So this goes into your test taking strategy, and every tutor will tell you this, like you have to really focus on process of elimination to get the right answer for a lot of these questions, because the right answers are so hard to find, while the wrong answers are so easy to slip into.
Well, you know, my recollection of this is the most intelligent and best reason for why is the answer that you selected correct is kind of like because the other ones are wrong.
Right, right. Yeah.
Probably the most efficient. But, absolutely. You know, focusing on, again, you know, this is quite interesting in your description of language and answer choice and stuff like that. So, you know, it seems to me that what they're really doing with the answer choices of these questions is building in like a separate reading test, right? Where not only do you have to recognize language, but understand what the message is from that language, which, I mean, sounds so ridiculously obvious and trivial, but that is a problem for people, right? Because, you know, they're under pressure, you know, they're scared, they're this, they're that. And so they, you know, when people are in that sort of emotional, psychological state, it seems to me they latch on to the familiar, right? So they see a word they recognize or a cluster of words or something. Or, boy, that would be the answer to a different question. You know, I think it makes them much more vulnerable to selecting that type of stuff.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely true. I mean, I think most students have this sort of, I don't know where it comes from, I guess sometime in school, I don't know if it's just American or students from the United States, but their response when they get panicked or really challenged with the question is just to sort of like pick the one that seems closest to the right answer and move on, which is exactly the opposite of what you want to do, because the one that seems closest to the right answer is almost always going to be the one that is the most attractive wrong answer. And that's what you see time after time. When in reality, what you should do is probably skip the question and come back to it, depending on your timing strategy, or kind of take a deep breath and try to re-understand the question. But if you're not picking an answer choice that is clearly correct, then you're basically just guessing, or you're being sucked into, you know, to the traps of the language of the test.
Mm-hmm. To some extent, though, I think, at least in logical reasoning and reading comprehension, all the answer choices are a guess in the sense that, you know, it's unlikely that the right answer choice would be in the same cluster of words that you would generate if you were making up the right answer. I mean, do you also experience it in that way?
I may not be fully understanding your question, but I do find a clear pattern that the right answer choice generally has language that you're not really looking for, but it is the only one that is completely correct. I don't know. I feel like that's kind of a hard question to answer, but I will go back to kind of what you said before. Like, the best way to know for sure is to know that four answer choices are wrong, and then you know you have the right answer.
Oh God, that's total security and LSAT happiness, isn't it? To know the other ones are wrong.
Absolutely.
Let's go back a little bit. Earlier on, you used the word, dealing with people's, people have to deal with their emotions that when taking the LSAT. Could you comment on that and how that affects people's LSAT prep, and further, how that would affect the way you would tutor somebody?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't necessarily like using the words deal with, because it kind of has like a negative connotation, but I just like to interact with. Yeah, exactly. I like to remember how I felt when I was going through the test. And I think that's something that gives me somewhat of a strength as a tutor.
On that note, if you could just pause for a second, because I thought this was very, very interesting on your site, which, by the way, is Cade's LSAT Prep. And I was going to get you to comment on this anyway, but since you raise it, I wanted to actually read this, which I think this is very interesting, and I think it speaks volumes about, you know, what would make somebody or could make somebody a good LSAT tutor, where you say, unlike some other tutors, I don't claim to be a test whiz. Testing didn't really come easily to me, but that means I've been in your shoes and I know how it feels to struggle for the score you want. After working diligently to personally understand the LSAT, I've dissected the test and developed an effective strategy for improving mine, anyone's scores. And just to make sure that nobody suggests that you didn't score high, you go on to say that you scored in the 99th percentile, which seems to me to be pretty good. So I wonder if you could comment on the role of having, in your words, to struggle yourself to some degree with LSAT prep. How does that impact on your teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was going to get into. And thanks for reading that quote from my website. I think that I've always been pretty good at school, as a student, but I definitely have always also had pretty severe testing anxiety, depending on the subject material. And I think that really came to a peak with the LSAT when I was studying for it, because it's just such a difficult test to feel prepared for and feel confident about, because it's changing every time you take it. I remember a few times when I bombed my practice test score, and I was like in the closet of my room back in North Carolina, like crying in the closet and calling my mom to see if I should still continue with this thing. But the point of that is just that, like, I know how it feels to really, really struggle with something that's challenging, especially when you're a good student and you haven't really been challenged this way at any point in your life, or at least not very much in this same way. So I try to take that into my teaching as much as I can, because I know that, you know, all my students are coming from different walks of life. Some of them are right out of college. I work with a lot of like working adults in their 30s and 40s who have children who, you know, have very strict work and childcare schedules and can only study at certain times and are overwhelmed. And everyone's going to be overwhelmed because of something. And I try to remember that and really try to empathize and support my students as much as I can. I find that in the community of test prep tutors that I've talked to and that I've met, there's a lot of them that are just sort of like test junkies that aren't very good teachers necessarily, or don't have that emotional capacity. And then there's some who are very savvy teachers and are very emotionally supportive, but aren't necessarily experts at the LSAT or at the test. And the best teachers really can marry both those things. And I think, although I'm still improving myself, I've gotten to an area where I've been able to do both those things very well. Where I know how it feels very recently to not only go through the LSAT studying process, but also the application process and the negotiation process of getting into law school. And I bring that into my sessions, and I work with my students, and I support them throughout the whole process. And I think that really shows if you read some of the reviews on my website and some of my customer feedback.
Well, I think it's certainly an asset to I mean, one of the problems with never having struggled with LSAT is that it's much more difficult to understand why somebody would have trouble with it, I think, right?
Right. I want to do a quick anecdote about that. I remember my first, when I worked for a big company, he was my first trainer for the LSAT. He came in, really nice guy, but he was sort of that test junkie type. And he was like, yeah, I don't know what the big problem is with this test. Like, I walked in, my first time ever taking it, I hardly studied. I had taken like two practice tests and I scored a 170, got a full ride to the school that I wanted to go to and just started teaching it. And he teaches that way too. Like, it's this easy thing that people can just grasp. And, you know, that was fine for me as like a teacher in training, but I just don't think that works very well with a lot of students when you work with them.
No, it's very destructive. It's very destructive.
Yeah.
I've always felt that single most important characteristic that any teacher has to have is the ability to get people to believe in themselves that they can get to that next level. And, you know, you certainly don't want to be exposed to LSAT teachers who sort of demoralize you, right?
It's so easy
to do when people are in such an emotionally vulnerable situation.
Yeah, I absolutely think that there are, you know, teachers and companies out there that profit off of people's vulnerability during this time. That's not what I'm here to do. Like, I'm obviously here to make an income to support myself, but I want to help people that want to do go into this career. You know, especially those who want to do it for good reasons. And, you know, you got to support people in this very emotional and difficult time if they're going to be able to reach the point where they have that confidence in themselves and, you know, don't need a tutor to rely on.
Yeah, you know, Kate, I think that is such an incredibly important point. Okay, that normally I would ask somebody at the interview to summarize a message, but I'm not going to ask you to summarize because I think you just did such a fantastic job a minute ago. And I think that's such an incredibly important final message for people. So why don't we end with you can tell everybody how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah. So you can find me online at cadeslsatprep.com. That's C-A-D-E-S. LSATprep.com. Feel free to book a consultation there or email me directly at cade@cadeslsatprep.com. And I look forward to working with anybody who'd like to work with me.
Well, that's fantastic. And 2 points. One, I really thank you for taking time out today to chat with me. And secondly, you know, you got tremendous insights into this. And I certainly would encourage you to get over to the Facebook group and participate in the conversations there. Thank you so much, Cade.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, John. I appreciate the opportunity.